I've been so excited about today. Looking forward to this over the last few weeks as we've kind of put this Sunday together with a special sermon and special music. And I've kind of been asking myself, you know, why am I so excited about that? And I think part of it is that I love George Herbert. I love poetry in general. I love music, obviously. But also, I'm always excited when a preacher comes up from the choir. I'm one of those odd critters myself. I'm a preacher who came up from the choir too. So I'm really excited to introduce Liz Hodgson, who's going to speak to you on the topic, Heaven in Ordinary, the Gracious God of George Herbert. Liz, please come forward.
Yeah, I thought I was coming because I'm an English professor, not because I'm a chorister, but hey, I'll take it. So the Feast of the Ascension has always kind of bothered me because I've never quite understood why we celebrate God going away from us. This never really made sense to me. And the poem by George Herbert that I'm going to talk about today has also been one I've really struggled with how to teach. So this is my chance to tackle both of my personal frustrations at the same time. So first you may ask, who was George Herbert anyway? He was an English poet from the 17th century, the same era in which the King James Bible translation was first published. So if you want to kind of anchor it. He knew John Donne and John Milton. His mother was a noted patron of the universities. His brother was a diplomat. And his family was a powerful family. But he chose in midlife to become a parish priest in a small town in rural England. His biographers don't really know why he did this. But it was definitely and clearly a choice to step away from his family's very public profile. Fortunately for us, while he was a parish priest, he also wrote and published a beautiful and deceptively simple collection of poems called The Temple, all about the struggles and joys of a believer's walk toward and sometimes away from God. So the title for my sermon today comes from one of the poems in that collection. It's a sonnet in which Herbert describes prayer as heaven in ordinary, man well-dressed. By ordinary here, Herbert means regular working clothes. So heaven in a work shirt, humans in fine silk. If that's what prayer is, I think it may also be the mystery of Ascension Day as well. We have the promise of being well-dressed in heavenly glory because God was willing to be clothed in ordinary human form. So I think it's possible that the way out of the dilemma for me of Ascension Day is that it's not really what it seems. It's not really about Jesus going to heaven at all. It's really about us having access to new life because Jesus was willing to walk away from that sublime, omnipotent communion with God. Maybe to put it another way, God only rises to the heavens again after falling into human form for our sake. The ascension of Jesus is really proof that God was willing to be heaven in ordinary for us. So this makes me wonder, who are we that God should be willing to dress us in human clothing? That question is one that another Herbert poem talks about, and that's the poem I want us to focus on today. It's a poem about a human who gets it all wrong. and it's entitled Redemption. So we're going to, it's in your leaflet, but we'll pop it up for you here so you can see it as well. And I'll read it for you so it's fresh in your mind. Redemption. Having been tenant long to a rich lord, not thriving, I resolved to be bold and make a suit unto him to afford a new small rented lease and cancel the old. In heaven at his manor I him sought. They told me there that he was lately gone about some land which he had dearly bought long since on earth to take possession. I straight returned and, knowing his great birth, sought him accordingly in great resorts, in cities, theatres, gardens, parks, and courts. At length I heard a ragged noise and mirth of thieves and murderers. There I him espied, who straight, "Your suit is granted," said, and died. It's a very simple poem in some ways. So simple that it actually took me quite a long time to figure out how to talk about it. Redemption, the title of the poem, becomes here quite literal. The word redemption means to buy back. It's a financial term. Our soft drink cans still say redemption value 5 cents on them. And this poem treats the financial metaphor as if it really is about money. The speaker, the I of the poem, the person talking, is a tenant, and he wants a new small rented lease. The tenant hears that the rich landlord, the holder of his lease, has dearly bought, and dear in the English sense of at a high price, some land. The tenant wants to bring a suit, as in a lawsuit. They want a new contract, a new lease at a better rent that maybe this time the tenant can afford. And this speaker thinks quite literally too. He looks for the lord in a manor house, a fancy mansion. When that doesn't pan out, the tenant assumes that even on earth, as a person of great birth, the lord will be staying in great resorts, an expensive hotel or an exclusive club. Our speaker assumes that a heavenly lord will look for heavenly company, and by heavenly, the tenant automatically thinks wealthy, powerful, exclusive. Now, of course, the situation is more complex than the speaker really understands, as we as the readers quickly deduce. The lord's manor is in heaven, so we know this isn't a regular billionaire at all. We might even remember Jesus saying, "In my Father's house there are many mansions," and recognize the allusion. The lord has dearly bought this land, and we know what the high price was. We recognize the mystery of Kairos time in this allegory. God is the Lord, and God dearly bought us long since in a sacrifice that God was willing to make at the beginning of time. But, and I really think this is the key to the whole poem. The speaker, the I of the poem, really does not understand this. Right from the start, this speaker, this tenant, doesn't seem to have any imagination at all. The tenant doesn't consider that a landlord, at least in a property-based proto-capitalist economy, might not automatically just give their tenants a lower rent. They don't seem to consider or reconsider their audacious plan for rent reduction at any point. The tenant also doesn't understand where to look for the Lord once back on earth. Doesn't really understand who the Lord is. The speaker, I think, doesn't even really know how to tell a good story about this quest. It's a plain list of places. And then, "At length I him espied," is about all the tenant can muster. You have the feeling that when the tenant gets home, if a neighbor were to ask how the quest went, the tenant would say, oh, it was okay. Hey, your vines are looking good. So our speaker doesn't understand that the dearly bought land is themselves, and that their own requesting is superfluous or irrelevant. Our tenant really doesn't understand the situation at all. This speaker here is pretty clueless. And this is, I think, clearest in the last phrase of the poem. At length, I heard a ragged noise and mirth of thieves and murderers. There I him espied, who straight your suit is granted said, and died. The speaker's language is a bit confused, talking about a ragged noise as if sound is a moth-eaten coat. But really what the speaker does not understand is the cause and effect of what they're seeing. We realize that the ragged noise and mirth of thieves and murderers is Golgotha, is the cross. We know even more clearly that the dying of the Lord and the granting of the suit are the same action. We know that the Lord is granting not only this poor tenant's request, but the requests of all of us for a new small rented lease on life and on love. But the speaker appears not to understand. They seem to think that the Lord makes the offer and then almost incidentally or accidentally dies. Worse still, the speaker seems not only pretty confused, but also rather indifferent and kind of selfish. They don't even consider a petition for rent control for everybody or affordable housing. It's my lease, my rent, my personal not thriving. And when the tenant does go get that new lease, they don't seem to notice that the suit is granted even before they ask for it. Worse still, the dying of the Lord appears almost as an afterthought to our tenant. They don't comment on that death or grieve over it or marvel over it or wonder over it. They don't realize that in this moment, heaven in ordinary, in ragged form, is the means by which they receive new grace, new hope, new freedom, new love. This tenant is both clueless and apparently ungrateful as well. And this witless, ungrateful, selfish tenant is to me really the miracle to which this poem refers. Because what Herbert is really saying in this poem is that God does not need us to marvel at this expensive sacrifice to purchase our freedom from sin and from death. God does not even need us to understand it. Herbert's speaker certainly does not understand what the Lord is offering here, or what it costs the Lord to offer it. But the Lord does not inquire of this tenant whether they have correctly appreciated the sacrifice. The Lord does not catechize the speaker, or expect a certain abject groveling, or even a thank you note. God does not even wait to be asked, in fact. So even for a clueless, indifferent, mercenary-minded tenant, God makes the same gift just as quickly, just as unconditionally, just as freely. Even for a tenant who does not understand the gift is still given. I'll say that again. Even for a human who does not understand the gift is still given. That, to me, is the heart of the matter. Now, some of you literary geeks might have noticed that this poem is a sonnet. And a sonnet in Herbert's day was a form that was used almost exclusively to describe a frustrated, rebuffed man, really almost always a man, begging desperately for love and complaining, whining would also work, about not getting it. Herbert's sonnet, however, is almost the opposite. It's about a person who gets what they need even before they really ask for it. And I think that this is the grace to which Ascension Day properly refers. God rises to the heavens to let us know that this heavenly grace is now ours, because God first came down and dearly bought our human hearts back for us. So if Herbert is right here, the point about ascension is not really that God goes up. It's that God came down so that we can rise to new hope and new life and new love. God prepares a place for us by becoming us, by associating not with the clouds, but with a ragged noise of thieves and murderers, and even more with the ordinary, clueless, selfish, indifferent humans that we so often are. The rising here isn't God's, it's ours. Our suit is granted. We are well dressed. And it is God's grace that dresses us. And to that I say, Amen.